Resolving thus in my heart did I sail o'er the sea. O ye sights and scenes of my youth, O all ye gleams of love, ye divine fleeting gleams, how could ye perish so soon for me? I think of you today as my dead ones. From you, my dearest dead ones, cometh unto me a sweet savour, heart-opening and melting. Verily it convulseth and openeth the heart of the lone seafarer. Still am I the richest and most to be envied, I, the lonesomest one, for I have possessed you, and ye possess me still. Tell me, to whom hath there ever fallen such rosy apples from the tree as have fallen unto me? Still am I, your love's heir and heritage, blooming to your memory with many hued wild-growing virtues, O ye dearest ones. Ah, we were made to remain nigh unto each other, ye kindly strange marvels, and not like timid birds did ye come to me and my longing, nay, but as trusting ones to a trusting one. Yea, made for faithfulness like me, and for fond eternities, must I now name you by your faithlessness, ye divine glances and fleeting gleams. No other name have I yet learned. Verily too early did ye die for me, ye fugitives, yet did ye not flee from me, nor did I flee from you. Innocent are we to each other in our faithlessness. To kill me did they strangle you, ye singing birds of my hopes. Yea, at you, ye dearest ones, did malice ever shoot its arrows to hit my heart. And they hit it, because ye were always my dearest, my possession and my possessedness. On that account had ye to die young and far too early. At my most vulnerable point did they shoot the arrow, namely at you, whose skin is like down, or more like the smile that dieth at a glance. But this word will I say unto mine enemies, what is all manslaughter in comparison with what ye have done unto me? Worse evil did ye do unto me than all manslaughter, the irretrievable did ye take from me. Thus do I speak unto you, mine enemies. Slew ye not my youth's visions and dearest marvels? My playmates took ye from me, the blessed spirits. To their memory do I deposit this wreath and this curse. This curse upon you, mine enemies. Have ye not made mine eternal short, as a tone dieth away in a cold night? Scarcely, as the twinkle of divine eyes, did it come to me, as a fleeting gleam. Thus spake once in a happy hour my purity, divine shall everything be unto me. Then did ye haunt me with foul phantoms. Ah, whither hath that happy hour now fled? All day shall be holy unto me. So spake once the wisdom of my youth, verily the language of a joyous wisdom. But then did ye enemies steal my nights, and sold them to sleepless torture. Ah, whither hath that joyous wisdom now fled? Once did I long for happy auspices. Then did ye lead an owl monster across my path, an adverse sign. Ah, whither did my tender longing then flee? All loathing did I once vow to renounce. Then did ye change my nigh ones and nearest ones into ulcerations. Ah, whither did my noblest vow then flee? As a blind one did I once walk in blessed ways. Then did ye cast filth on the blind one's course, and now he is disgusted with the old footpath. And when I performed my hardest task, and celebrated the triumph of my victories, then did ye make those who loved me call out that I then grieved them most. Verily it was always your doing. Ye embittered to me my best honey and the diligence of my best bees. To my charity have ye ever sent the most impudent beggars. Around my sympathy have ye ever crowded the incurably shameless. Thus have ye wounded the faith of my virtue. And when I offered my holiest as a sacrifice, immediately did your piety put its fatter gifts beside it, so that my holiest suffocated in the fumes of your fat. And once did I want to dance as I had never yet danced. Beyond all heavens did I want to dance. Then did ye seduce my favourite minstrel. And now hath he struck up an awful, melancholy air. Alas, he tooted as a mournful horn to mine ear. Murderous minstrel, instrument of evil, most innocent instrument, already did I stand prepared for the best dance, then didst thou slay my rapture with thy tones. Only in the dance do I know how to speak the parable of the highest things, and now hath my grandest parable remained unspoken in my limbs. Unspoken and unrealized hath my highest hope remained, and there have perished for me all the visions and consolations of my youth. How did I ever bear it? How did I survive and surmount such wounds? How did my soul rise again out of these sepulchres? Yea, something invulnerable, unburiable is with me, something that would rend rocks asunder. It is called my will. Silently doth it proceed, and unchanged throughout the years. Its course will it go upon my feet, mine old will. Hard of heart is its nature and invulnerable. Invulnerable am I only in my heel. Ever livest thou there, and art like thyself, thou most patient one. Ever hast thou burst all shackles of the tomb. In thee still liveth also the unrealizedness of my youth, and as life and youth sittest thou here hopeful on the yellow ruins of graves. Yea, thou art still for me the demolisher of all graves. Hail to thee, my will, and only where there are graves are there resurrections. Thus sang Zarathustra. 34. Self-surpassing. Will to truth, do ye call it, ye wisest ones, that which impelleth you and maketh you ardent? Will for the thinkableness of all being, thus do I call your will. All being would ye make thinkable, for ye doubt with good reason whether it be already thinkable. But it shall accommodate and bend itself to you, so willeth your will. Smooth shall it become and subject to the spirit, as its mirror and reflection. That is your entire will, ye wisest ones, as a will to power, and even when ye speak of good and evil and of estimates of value. Ye would still create a world before which ye can bow the knee. Such is your ultimate hope and ecstasy. The ignorant, to be sure, the people, they are like a river on which a boat floateth along, and in the boat sit the estimates of value, Solomon disguised. Your will and your valuations have ye put on the river of becoming. It betrayeth unto me an old will to power, what is believed by the people as good and evil. It was ye, ye wisest ones, who put such guests in this boat, and gave them pomp and proud names, ye and your ruling will. Onward the river now carrieth your boat, it must carry it, a small matter if the rough wave foameth and angrily resisteth its keel. It is not the river that is your danger and the end of your good and evil, ye wisest ones, but that will itself, the will to power, the unexhausted procreating life will. But that ye may understand my gospel of good and evil, for that purpose will I tell you my gospel of life, and of the nature of all living things. The living thing did I follow. I walked in the broadest and narrowest paths to learn its nature. With a hundred-faced mirror did I catch its glance when its mouth was shut, so that its eye might speak unto me, and its eye spake unto me. But wherever I found living things, there heard I also the language of obedience. All living things are obeying things. And this heard I secondly, whatever cannot obey itself is commanded. Such is the nature of living things. This, however, is the third thing which I heard, namely that commanding is more difficult than obeying, and not only because the commander beareth the burden of all obeyers, and because this burden readily crusheth him. An attempt and a risk seemed all commanding unto me, and whenever it commandeth, the living thing risketh itself thereby. Yea, even when it commandeth itself, then also must it atone for its commanding. Of its own law must it become the judge, and avenger, and victim. How doth this happen? So did I ask myself. What persuadeth the living thing to obey, and command, and even be obedient in commanding? Hearken now unto my word, ye wisest ones. Test it seriously, whether I have crept into the heart of life itself, and into the roots of its heart. Wherever I found a living thing, there found I will to power, and even in the will of the servant found I the will to be master. That to the stronger the weaker shall serve, thereto persuadeth he his will who would be master over a still weaker one, that delight alone he is unwilling to forego. And as the lesser surrendereth himself to the greater, that he may have delight and power over the least of all, so doth even the greatest surrender himself, and staketh life for the sake of power. It is the surrender of the greatest to run risk and danger, and play dice for death. And where there is sacrifice and service and love glances, there also is the will to be master. By byways doth the weaker then slink into the fortress, and into the heart of the mightier one, and there stealeth power. And this secret spake Life herself unto me. Behold, said she, I am that which must ever surpass itself. To be sure ye call it will to procreation, or impulse towards a goal, towards the higher, remoter, more manifold. But all that is one and the same secret. Rather would I succumb than disown this one thing, and verily where there is succumbing and leaf falling, lo, there doth life sacrifice itself for power. That I have to be struggle, and becoming, and purpose, and cross-purpose, ah, he who divineth my will, divineth well also on what crooked paths it hath to tread. Whatever I create, and however much I love it, soon must I be adverse to it, and to my love. So willeth my will. And even thou, discerning one, art only a path and footstep of my will. Verily my will to power walketh even on the feet of thy will to truth. He certainly did not hit the truth who shot at it the formula, will to existence. That will doth not exist. For what is not, cannot will. That, however, which is in existence, how could it still strive for existence? Only where there is life is there also will, not, however, will to life, but, so I teach thee, will to power. Much is reckoned higher than life itself by the living one, but out of the very reckoning speaketh the will to power. Thus did life once teach me, and thereby, ye wisest ones, do I solve you the riddle of your hearts. Verily I say unto you, good and evil, which would be everlasting, it doth not exist. Of its own accord must it ever surpass itself anew. With your values and formulae of good and evil, ye exercise power, ye valuing ones, and that is your secret love, and the sparkling, trembling, and overflowing of your souls. But a stronger power groweth out of your values, and a new surpassing. By it breaketh egg and eggshell. And he who hath to be a creator in good and evil, verily he hath first to be a destroyer, and break values in pieces. Thus doth the greatest evil pertain to the greatest good. That, however, is the creating good. Let us speak thereof, ye wisest ones, even though it be bad. To be silent is worse. All suppressed truths become poisonous. And let everything break up which can break up by our truths. Many a house is still to be built. Thus spake Zarathustra. 35. The Sublime Ones. Calm is the bottom of my sea. Who would guess that it hideth droll monsters? Unmoved is my depth, but it sparkleth with swimming enigmas and laughters. A sublime one saw I today, a solemn one, a penitent of the spirit. Oh, how my soul laughed at his ugliness! With upraised breast, and like those who draw in their breath, thus did he stand, the sublime one, and in silence. O'erhung with ugly truths, the spoil of his hunting, and rich in torn raiment, many thorns also hung on him, but I saw no rose. Not yet had he learned laughing and beauty. Gloomy did this hunter return from the forest of knowledge. From the fight with wild beasts returned he home, but even yet a wild beast gazeth out of his seriousness, an unconquered wild beast. As a tiger doth he ever stand on the point of springing, but I do not like those strained souls. Ungracious is my taste towards all those self-engrossed ones. And ye tell me, friends, that there is to be no dispute about taste and tasting, but all life is a dispute about taste and tasting. Taste, that is weight at the same time, and scales and wear, and alas for every living thing that would live without dispute about weight and scales and wear. Should he become weary of his sublimeness, this sublime one, then only will his beauty begin, and then only will I taste him and find him savoury. And only when he turneth away from himself will he o'erleap his own shadow, and verily into his sun. Far too long did he sit in the shade. The cheeks of the penitent of the spirit became pale. He almost starved on his expectations. Contempt is still in his eye, and loathing hideth in his mouth. To be sure he now resteth, but he hath not yet taken rest in the sunshine. As the ox ought he to do, and his happiness should smell of the earth, and not of contempt for the earth. As a white ox would I like to see him, which, snorting and lowing, walketh before the ploughshare, and his lowing should also lord all that is earthly. Dark is still his countenance, the shadow of his hand danceth upon it, o'ershadowed is still the sense of his eye. His deed itself is still the shadow upon him, his doing obscureth the doer. Not yet hath he overcome his deed. To be sure I love in him the shoulders of the ox, but now do I want to see also the eye of the angel. Also his hero will hath he still to unlearn. An exalted one shall he be, and not only a sublime one. The ether itself should raise him, the willless one. He hath subdued monsters, he hath solved enigmas, but he should also redeem his monsters and enigmas. Into heavenly children should he transform them. As yet hath his knowledge not learned to smile, and to be without jealousy. As yet hath his gushing passion not become calm in beauty. Verily, not in satiety shall his longing cease and disappear, but in beauty. Gracefulness belongeth to the munificence of the magnanimous. His arm across his head, thus should the hero repose, thus should he also surmount his repose. But precisely to the hero is beauty the hardest thing of all. Unattainable is beauty by all ardent wills. A little more, a little less. Precisely this is much here, it is the most here. To stand with relaxed muscles and with unharnessed will, that is the hardest for all of you, ye sublime ones. When power becometh gracious and descendeth into the visible, I call such condescension beauty. And from no one do I want beauty so much as from thee, thou powerful one. Let thy goodness be thy last self-conquest. All evil do I accredit to thee, therefore do I desire of thee the good. Verily I have often laughed at the weaklings, who think themselves good because they have crippled paws. The virtue of the pillar shalt thou strive after. More beautiful doth it ever become, and more graceful, but internally harder and more sustaining, the higher it riseth. Yea, thou sublime one, one day shalt thou also be beautiful, and hold up the mirror to thine own beauty. Then will thy soul thrill with divine desires, and there will be adoration even in thy vanity. For this is the secret of the soul. When the hero hath abandoned it, then only approacheth it in dreams, the superhero. Thus spake Zarathustra. 36. The Land of Culture. Too far did I fly into the future. A horror seized upon me. And when I looked around me, lo, there time was my sole contemporary. Then did I fly backwards, homewards, and always faster. Thus did I come unto you, ye present-day men, and into the land of culture. For the first time brought I an eye to see you, and good desire. Verily with longing in my heart did I come. But how did it turn out with me? Although so alarmed, I had yet to laugh. Never did mine eye see anything so motley coloured. I laughed and laughed, while my foot still trembled and my heart as well. Here, forsooth, is the home of all the paint-pots, said I. With 50 patches painted on faces and limbs, so sat ye there, to mine astonishment, ye present-day men. And with 50 mirrors around you, which flattered your play of colours and repeated it. Verily ye could wear no better masks, ye present-day men, than your own faces. Who could recognise you? Written all over with the characters of the past, and these characters also pencilled over with new characters. Thus have ye concealed yourselves well from all decipherers. And though one be a trier of the reins, who still believeth that ye have reins, out of colours ye seem to be baked, and out of glued scraps. All times and people's gaze diverse coloured out of your veils, all customs and beliefs speak diverse coloured out of your gestures. He who would strip you of veils and wrappers and paints and gestures would just have enough left to scare the crows. Verily, I myself am the scared crow that once saw you naked and without paint, and I flew away when the skeleton ogled at me. Rather would I be a day-labourer in the netherworld and among the shades of the bygone, fatter and fuller than ye are, forsooth, the nether-worldlings. This, yea, this, is bitterness to my bowels, that I can neither endure you naked nor clothed, ye present-day men. All that is unhomelike in the future, and whatever maketh strayed birds shiver, is verily more homelike and familiar than your reality. For thus speak ye, real are we, holy, and without faith and superstition, thus do ye plume yourselves. Alas, even without plumes. Indeed, how would you be able to believe, ye diverse coloured ones, ye who are pictures of all that hath ever been believed? Perambulating refutations are ye of belief itself, and a dislocation of all thought, untrustworthy ones. Thus do I call you, ye real ones. All periods prate against one another in your spirits, and the dreams and pratings of all periods were even realer than your awakeness. Unfruitful are ye, therefore do ye lack belief. But he who had to create had always his presaging dreams and astral premonitions, and believed in believing. Half-open doors are ye, at which grave-diggers wait, and this is your reality. Everything deserveth to perish. Alas, how ye stand there before me, ye unfruitful ones, how lean your ribs, and many of you surely have had knowledge thereof. Many a one hath said, there hath surely a god filched something from me secretly whilst I slept, verily enough to make a girl for himself therefrom. Amazing is the poverty of my ribs, thus hath spoken many a present-day man. Yea, ye are laughable unto me, ye present-day men, and especially when ye marvel at yourselves. And woe unto me if I could not laugh at your marvelling, and had to swallow all that is repugnant in your platters. As it is, however, I will make lighter of you, since I have to carry what is heavy, and what matter if beetles and maybugs also alight on my load? Verily it shall not, on that account, become heavier to me. And not from you, ye present-day men, shall my great weariness arise. Ah, whither shall I now ascend with my longing? From all mountains do I look out for fatherlands and motherlands. But a home have I found nowhere. Unsettled am I in all cities, and decamping at all gates. Alien to me and a mockery are the present-day men, to whom of late my heart impelled me, and exiled am I from fatherlands and motherlands. Thus do I love only my children's land, the undiscovered in the remotest sea. For it do I bid my sails search and search. Unto my children will I make amends for being the child of my fathers, and unto all the future for this present day. Thus spake Zarathustra.
37. Immaculate Perception. When yester-eve the moon arose, then did I fancy it about to bear a sun, so broad and teeming did it lie on the horizon. But it was a liar with its pregnancy, and sooner will I believe in the man in the moon than in the woman. To be sure, little of a man is he also, that timid night-reveller. Verily, with a bad conscience doth he stalk over the roofs. For he is covetous and jealous, the monk in the moon, covetous of the earth and all the joys of lovers. Nay, I like him not, that tomcat on the roofs. Hateful unto me are all that slink around half-closed windows. Piously and silently doth he stalk along on the star carpets, but I like no light-treading human feet, on which not even a spur jingleth. Every honest one's step speaketh. The cat, however, stealeth along over the ground. Lo, cat-like doth the moon come along, and dishonestly. This parable speak I unto you, sentimental dissemblers, unto you, the pure discerners. You do I call covetous ones. Also ye love the earth, and the earthly. I have divined you well. But shame is in your love, and a bad conscience. Ye are like the moon. To despise the earthly hath your spirit been persuaded, but not your bowels. These, however, are the strongest in you. And now is your spirit ashamed to be at the service of your bowels, and goeth byways and lying ways to escape its own shame. That would be the highest thing for me, so saith your lying spirit unto itself, to gaze upon life without desire, and not like the dog with hanging out tongue. To be happy in gazing, with dead will, free from the grip and greed of selfishness, cold and ashy grey all over, but with intoxicated moon eyes. That would be the dearest thing to me. Thus doth the seduced one seduce himself, to love the earth as the moon loveth it, and with the eye only to feel its beauty. And this do I call immaculate perception of all things, to want nothing else from them but to be allowed to lie before them as a mirror with 100 facets. O, ye sentimental dissemblers, ye covetous ones, ye lack innocence in your desire, and now do ye defame desiring on that account. Verily, not as creators, as procreators, or as jubilators do ye love the earth. Where is innocence? Where there is will to procreation. And he who seeketh to create beyond himself hath for me the purest will. Where is beauty? Where I must will with my whole will. Where I will love and perish, that an image may not remain merely an image. Loving and perishing, these have rhymed from eternity. Will to love, that is to be ready also for death. Thus do I speak unto you cowards. But now doth your emasculated ogling profess to be contemplation, and that which can be examined with cowardly eyes is to be christened beautiful, O ye violators of noble names. But it shall be your curse, ye immaculate ones, ye pure discerners, that ye shall never bring forth, even though ye lie broad and teeming on the horizon. Verily, ye fill your mouth with noble words, and we are to believe that your heart overfloweth, ye cozeners. But my words are poor, contemptible, stammering words.
gladly do I pick up what falleth from the table at your repasts. Yet still can I say therewith the truth to dissemblers, yea, my fish-bones, shells, and prickly leaves shall tickle the noses of dissemblers. Bad air is always about you and your repasts. Your lascivious thoughts, your lies and secrets are indeed in the air. Dare only to believe in yourselves and in your inward parts. He who doth not believe in himself always lieth. A god's mask have ye hung in front of you, ye pure ones. Into a god's mask hath your execrable coiling snake crawled. Verily ye deceive, ye contemplative ones. Even Zarathustra was once the dupe of your godlike exterior. He did not divine the serpent's coil with which it was stuffed. A god's soul I once thought I saw, playing in your games, ye pure discerners. No better arts did I once dream of than your arts. Serpent's filth and evil odour, the distance concealed from me, and that a lizard's craft prowled thereabouts lasciviously. But I came nigh unto you. Then came to me the day, and now cometh it to you. At an end is the moon's love affair. See, there, surprised and pale doth it stand, before the rosy dawn. For already she cometh, the glowing one. Her love to the earth cometh. Innocence and creative desire is all solar love. See there, how she cometh impatiently over the sea. Do ye not feel the thirst and the hot breath of her love? At the sea would she suck, and drink its depths to her height. Now riseth the desire of the sea with its thousand breasts. Kissed and sucked would it be by the thirst of the sun. Vapour would it become, and height, and path of light, and light itself. Verily like the sun do I love life and all deep seas. And this meaneth to me knowledge, all that is deep shall ascend to my height. Thus spake Zarathustra. 38. Scholars. When I lay asleep, then did a sheep eat at the ivy wreath on my head. It ate, and said thereby, Zarathustra is no longer a scholar. It said this, and went away clumsily and proudly. A child told it to me. I like to lie here where the children play, beside the ruined wall, among thistles and red poppies. A scholar am I still to the children, and also to the thistles and red poppies. Innocent are they, even in their wickedness. But to the sheep I am no longer a scholar, so willeth my lot. Blessings upon it. For this is the truth. I have departed from the house of the scholars, and the door have I also slammed behind me. Too long did my soul sit hungry at their table. Not like them have I got the knack of investigating, as the knack of nut-cracking. Freedom do I love, and the air over fresh soil. Rather would I sleep on ox-skins than on their honours and dignities. I am too hot and scorched with mine own thought. Often is it ready to take away my breath. Then have I to go into the open air and away from all dusty rooms. But they sit cool in the cool shade. They want in everything to be merely spectators, and they avoid sitting where the sun burneth on the steps. Like those who stand in the street and gape at the passers-by, thus do they also wait, and gape at the thoughts which others have thought. Should one lay hold of them, then do they raise a dust like flower-sacks, and involuntarily. But who would divine that their dust came from corn, and from the yellow delight of the summer fields? When they give themselves out as wise, then do their petty sayings and truths chill me. In their wisdom there is often an odour as if it came from the swamp, and verily I have even heard the frog croak in it. Clever are they. They have dexterous fingers. What doth my simplicity pretend to beside their multiplicity? All threading and knitting and weaving do their fingers understand. Thus do they make the hose of the spirit. Good clockworks are they. Only be careful to wind them up properly. Then do they indicate the hour without mistake, and make a modest noise thereby. Like millstones do they work, and like pestles, throw only seed corn unto them. They know well how to grind corn small and make white dust out of it. They keep a sharp eye on one another, and do not trust each other the best. Ingenious in little artifices, they wait for those whose knowledge walketh on lame feet, like spiders do they wait. I saw them always prepare their poison with precaution, and always did they put glass gloves on their fingers in doing so. They also know how to play with false dice, and so eagerly did I find them playing that they perspired thereby. We are alien to each other, and their virtues are even more repugnant to my taste than their falsehoods and false dice. And when I lived with them, then did I live above them. Therefore did they take a dislike to me. They want to hear nothing of anyone walking above their heads, and so they put wood and earth and rubbish betwixt me and their heads. Thus did they deafen the sound of my tread, and least have I hitherto been heard by the most learned. All mankind's faults and weaknesses did they put betwixt themselves and me. They call it false ceiling in their houses. But nevertheless I walk with my thoughts above their heads, and even should I walk on mine own errors, still would I be above them and their heads. For men are not equal, so speaketh justice, and what I will they may not will. Thus spake Zarathustra. 39. Poets. Since I have known the body better, said Zarathustra to one of his disciples, the spirit hath only been to me symbolically spirit, and all the imperishable. That is also but a simile. So have I heard thee say once before, answered the disciple. And then thou addedst, but the poets lie too much. Why didst thou say that the poets lie too much? Why, said Zarathustra, thou askest why? I do not belong to those who may be asked after their why. Is my experience but of yesterday? It is long ago that I experienced the reasons for mine opinions. Should I not have to be a cask of memory if I also wanted to have my reasons with me? It is already too much for me even to retain mine opinions, and many a bird flieth away. And sometimes also do I find a fugitive creature in my dovecot, which is alien to me, and trembleth when I lay my hand upon it. But what did Zarathustra once say unto thee? That the poets lie too much. But Zarathustra also is a poet. Believest thou that he there spake the truth? Why dost thou believe it? The disciple answered, I believe in Zarathustra. But Zarathustra shook his head and smiled. Belief doth not sanctify me, said he, least of all the belief in myself. But granting that someone did say in all seriousness that the poets lie too much, he was right. We do lie too much. We also know too little and are bad learners, so we are obliged to lie. And which of us poets hath not adulterated his wine? Many a poisonous hotch-potch hath evolved in our cellars. Many an indescribable thing hath there been done. And because we know little, therefore we are pleased from the heart with the poor in spirit, especially when they are young women. And even of those things we are desirous, which old women tell one another in the evening, this do we call the eternally feminine in us. And as if there were a special secret access to knowledge, which choketh up for those who learn anything, so do we believe in the people and in their wisdom. This, however, do all poets believe, that whoever pricketh up his ears when lying in the grass, or on lonely slopes, learneth something of the things that are betwixt heaven and earth. And if there come unto them tender emotions, then do the poets always think that nature herself is in love with them, and that she stealeth to their ear to whisper secrets into it, and amorous flatteries. Of this do they plume and pride themselves before all mortals. Ah, there are so many things betwixt heaven and earth of which only the poets have dreamed. and especially above the heavens, for all gods are poet symbolizations, poet sophistications. Verily, ever are we drawn aloft, that is, to the realm of the clouds. On these do we set our gaudy puppets, and then call them gods and supermen. Are not they light enough for those chairs, all these gods and supermen? Ah, how I am weary of all the inadequate that is insisted on as actual. Ah, how I am weary of the poets. When Zarathustra so spake, his disciple resented it, but was silent. And Zarathustra also was silent, and his eye directed itself inwardly, as if it gazed into the far distance. At last he sighed and drew breath. I am of today, and heretofore, said he thereupon, but something is in me that is of the morrow, and the day following, and the hereafter. I became weary of the poets, of the old and of the new. Superficial are they all unto me, and shallow seas. They did not think sufficiently into the depth, therefore their feeling did not reach to the bottom. Some sensation of voluptuousness and some sensation of tedium, these have as yet been their best contemplation. Ghost-breathing and ghost-whisking seemeth to me all the jingle-jangling of their harps. What have they known hitherto of the fervor of tones? They are also not pure enough for me. They all muddle their water that it may seem deep. And fain would they thereby prove themselves reconcilers. But mediaries and mixers are they unto me, and half, and impure. Ah, I cast indeed my net into their sea, and meant to catch good fish, but always did I draw up the head of some ancient god. Thus did the sea give a stone to the hungry one, and they themselves may well originate from the sea. Certainly one findeth pearls in them. Thereby they are the more like hard mollusks, and instead of a soul, I have often found in them salt slime. They have learned from the sea also its vanity. Is not the sea the peacock of peacocks? Even before the ugliest of all buffaloes doth it spread out its tail, never doth it tire of its lace fan of silver and silk. Disdainfully doth the buffalo glance thereat, nigh to the sand with its soul, nigher still to the thicket, nighest, however, to the swamp. What is beauty and sea and peacock splendor to it? This parable I speak unto the poets. Verily their spirit itself is the peacock of peacocks, and a sea of vanity. Spectators seeketh the spirit of the poet, should they even be buffaloes. But of this spirit became I weary, and I see the time coming when it will become weary of itself. Yea, changed have I seen the poets, and their glance turned towards themselves. Penitents of the spirit have I seen appearing, they grew out of the poets. Thus spake Zarathustra. 40. Great Events. There is an isle in the sea, not far from the happy isles of Zarathustra, on which a volcano ever smoketh, of which isle the people, and especially the old women amongst them, say that it is placed as a rock before the gate of the netherworld, but that through the volcano itself the narrow way leadeth downwards, which conducteth to this gate. Now about the time that Zarathustra sojourned on the happy isles, it happened that a ship anchored at the isle on which standeth the smoking mountain, and the crew went ashore to shoot rabbits. About the noontide hour, however, when the captain and his men were together again, they saw suddenly a man coming towards them through the air, and a voice said distinctly, "It is time. It is the highest time." But when the figure was nearest to them, it flew past quickly, however, like a shadow, in the direction of the volcano. Then did they recognize with the greatest surprise that it was Zarathustra. For they had all seen him before, except the captain himself, and they loved him as the people love, in such wise that love and awe were combined in equal degree. "Behold," said the old helmsman, "there goeth Zarathustra to hell." About the same time that these sailors landed on the Fire Isle, there was a rumor that Zarathustra had disappeared. and when his friends were asked about it, they said that he had gone on board a ship by night, without saying whither he was going. Thus there arose some uneasiness. After 3 days, however, there came the story of the ship's crew in addition to this uneasiness, and then did all the people say that the devil had taken Zarathustra. His disciples laughed, sure enough, at this talk, and one of them said even, "Sooner would I believe that Zarathustra had taken the devil." But at the bottom of their hearts they were all full of anxiety and longing. So their joy was great when, on the 5th day, Zarathustra appeared amongst them. And this is the account of Zarathustra's interview with the fire dog. "The earth," said he, "hath a skin, and this skin hath diseases. One of these diseases, for example, is called man. And another of these diseases is called the fire dog. Concerning him, men have greatly deceived themselves, and let themselves be deceived. To fathom this mystery did I go o'er the sea, and I have seen the truth naked, verily, barefooted up to the neck. Now do I know how it is concerning the fire dog, and likewise concerning all the spouting and subversive devils, of which not only old women are afraid. Up with thee, fire dog, out of thy depth," cried I, "and confess how deep that depth is. Whence cometh that which thou snortest up? Thou drinkest copiously at the sea, that doth thine embittered eloquence betray. In sooth, for a dog of the depth, thou takest thy nourishment too much from the surface. At the most I regard thee as the ventriloquist of the earth, and ever, when I have heard subversive and spouting devils speak, I have found them like thee, embittered, mendacious, and shallow. Ye understand how to roar and obscure with ashes. Ye are the best braggarts, and have sufficiently learned the art of making dregs boil. Where ye are, there must always be dregs at hand, and much that is spongy, hollow, and compressed. It wanteth to have freedom. Freedom, ye all roar most eagerly, but I have unlearned the belief in great events, when there is much roaring and smoke about them. And believe me, friend Hullabaloo, the greatest events are not our noisiest, but our stillest hours. Not around the inventors of new noise, but around the inventors of new values doth the world revolve. Inaudibly it revolveth. And just own to it. Little had ever taken place when thy noise and smoke passed away. What if a city did become a mummy and a statue lay in the mud? And this do I say also to the o'erthrowers of statues. It is certainly the greatest folly to throw salt into the sea and statues into the mud. In the mud of your contempt lay the statue, but it is just its law that out of contempt its life and living beauty grow again. With diviner features doth it now arise, seducing by its suffering, and verily it will yet thank you for o'erthrowing it, ye subverters. This counsel, however, do I counsel to kings and churches, and to all that is weak with age or virtue. Let yourselves be o'erthrown, that ye may again come to life, and that virtue may come to you. Thus spake I before the fire dog. Then did he interrupt me sullenly, and asked, "Church, what is that?" "Church," answered I, "that is a kind of state, and indeed the most mendacious. But remain quiet, thou dissembling dog. Thou surely knowest thine own species best. Like thyself the state is a dissembling dog. Like thee doth it like to speak with smoke and roaring, to make believe like thee that it speaketh out of the heart of things. For it seeketh by all means to be the most important creature on earth, the state, and people think it so." When I had said this, the fire dog acted as if mad with envy. "What," cried he, "the most important creature on earth, and people think it so?" And so much vapour and terrible voices came out of his throat that I thought he would choke with vexation and envy. At last he became calmer, and his panting subsided. As soon, however, as he was quiet, I said laughingly, Thou art angry, fire dog, so I am in the right about thee. And that I may also maintain the right, hear the story of another fire dog. He speaketh actually out of the heart of the earth. Gold doth his breath exhale, and golden rain, so doth his heart desire. What are ashes and smoke and hot dregs to him? Laughter flitteth from him like a variegated cloud. Adverse is he to thy gargling and spewing and grips in the bowels. The gold, however, and the laughter, these doth he take out of the heart of the earth, for that thou mayest know it, the heart of the earth is of gold. When the fire dog heard this, he could no longer endure to listen to me. Abashed did he draw in his tail, said bow wow in a cowed voice, and crept down into his cave. Thus told Zarathustra. His disciples, however, hardly listened to him, so great was their eagerness to tell him about the sailors, the rabbits, and the flying man. What am I to think of it? Said Zarathustra. Am I indeed a ghost? But it may have been my shadow. Ye have surely heard something of the wanderer and his shadow. One thing, however, is certain. I must keep a tighter hold of it, otherwise it will spoil my reputation. And once more Zarathustra shook his head and wondered. What am I to think of it? Said he once more. Why did the ghost cry, It is time, it is the highest time? For what is it then, the highest time? Thus spake Zarathustra. 41. The Soothsayer. And I saw a great sadness come over mankind, the best turned weary of their works. A doctrine appeared, a faith ran beside it. All is empty, all is alike, all hath been. And from all hills there re-echoed, All is empty, all is alike, all hath been. To be sure we have harvested, but why have all our fruits become rotten and brown? What was it fell last night from the evil moon? In vain was all our labour, poison hath our wine become, the evil eye hath singed yellow our fields and hearts. Arid have we all become, and fire falling upon us, then do we turn dust like ashes, yea, the fire itself have we made aweary. All our fountains have dried up, even the sea hath receded, all the ground trieth to gape, but the depth will not swallow. Alas, where is there still a sea in which one could be drowned, so soundeth our plaint, across shallow swamps. Verily, even for dying have we become too weary, now do we keep awake and live on in sepulchres. Thus did Zarathustra hear a soothsayer speak, and the foreboding touched his heart and transformed him. Sorrowfully did he go about and wearily, and he became like unto those of whom the soothsayer had spoken. Verily, said he unto his disciples, a little while, and there cometh the long twilight. Alas, how shall I preserve my light through it? That it may not smother in this sorrowfulness. To remoter worlds shall it be a light, and also to remotest nights. Thus did Zarathustra go about grieved in his heart, and for 3 days he did not take any meat or drink. He had no rest and lost his speech. At last it came to pass that he fell into a deep sleep. His disciples, however, sat around him in long night watches, and waited anxiously to see if he would awake and speak again and recover from his affliction. And this is the discourse that Zarathustra spake when he awoke. His voice, however, came unto his disciples as from afar. Hear, I pray you, the dream that I dreamed, my friends, and help me to divine its meaning. A riddle is it still unto me, this dream. The meaning is hidden in it and encaged, and doth not yet fly above it on free pinions. All life had I renounced, so I dreamed. Night watchman and grave guardian had I become, aloft, in the lone mountain fortress of death. There did I guard his coffins. Full stood the musty vaults of those trophies of victory. Out of glass coffins did vanquished life gaze upon me. The odour of dust-covered eternities did I breathe. Sultry and dust-covered lay my soul, and who could have aired his soul there? Brightness of midnight was ever around me, lonesomeness cowered beside her, and, as a third, death-rattle stillness, the worst of my female friends. Keys did I carry, the rustiest of all keys, and I knew how to open with them the most creaking of all gates. Like a bitterly angry croaking ran the sound through the long corridors when the leaves of the gate opened. Ungraciously did this bird cry, unwillingly was it awakened. But more frightful, even, and more heart-strangling was it, when it again became silent and still all around, and I alone sat in that malignant silence. Thus did time pass with me and slip by, if time there still was. What do I know thereof? But at last there happened that which awoke me. Thrice did there peal peals at the gate like thunders, thrice did the vaults resound and howl again. Then did I go to the gate. "Alpa," cried I, "who carrieth his ashes unto the mountain? Alpa, Alpa, who carrieth his ashes unto the mountain?" And I pressed the key and pulled at the gate, and exerted myself, but not a finger's breadth was it yet open. Then did a roaring wind tear the folds apart, whistling, whizzing, and piercing, it threw unto me a black coffin. And in the roaring and whistling and whizzing the coffin burst up, and spouted out a thousand peals of laughter. And a thousand caricatures of children, angels, owls, fools, and child-sized butterflies laughed and mocked and roared at me. Fearfully was I terrified thereby. It prostrated me, and I cried with horror as I ne'er cried before. But mine own crying awoke me, and I came to myself. Thus did Zarathustra relate his dream, and then was silent, for as yet he knew not the interpretation thereof. But the disciple whom he loved most arose quickly, seized Zarathustra's hand, and said, "Thy life itself interpreteth unto us this dream, O Zarathustra. Art thou not thyself the wind with shrill whistling which bursteth open the gates of the fortress of death? Art thou not thyself the coffin full of many-hued malices and angel caricatures of life? Verily, like a thousand peals of children's laughter, cometh Zarathustra into all sepulchres, laughing at those night watchmen and grave guardians, and whoever else rattleth with sinister keys. With thy laughter wilt thou frighten and prostrate them, fainting and recovering will demonstrate thy power over them. And when the long twilight cometh, and the mortal weariness, even then wilt thou not disappear from our firmament, thou advocate of life. New stars hast thou made us see, and new nocturnal glories. Verily, laughter itself hast thou spread out over us like a many-hued canopy. Now will children's laughter ever from coffins flow, now will a strong wind ever come victoriously unto all mortal weariness. Of this thou art thyself the pledge and the prophet. Verily, they themselves didst thou dream, thine enemies. That was thy sorest dream. But as thou awokest from them and camest to thyself, so shall they awaken from themselves and come unto thee." Thus spake the disciple, and all the others then thronged around Zarathustra, grasped him by the hands, and tried to persuade him to leave his bed and his sadness and return unto them. Zarathustra, however, sat upright on his couch with an absent look. Like one returning from long foreign sojourn did he look on his disciples, and examined their features, but still he knew them not. When, however, they raised him and set him upon his feet, behold, all on a sudden his eye changed. He understood everything that had happened, stroked his beard, and said with a strong voice, "Well, this hath just its time. But see to it, my disciples, that we have a good repast, and without delay. Thus do I mean to make amends for bad dreams. The soothsayer, however, shall eat and drink at my side, and verily I will yet show him a sea in which he can drown himself." Thus spake Zarathustra. Then did he gaze long into the face of the disciple who had been the dream interpreter, and shook his head.
42. Redemption. When Zarathustra went one day over the great bridge, then did the cripples and beggars surround him, and a hunchback spake thus unto him.